Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson. Fred, I was cleaning out my archives and my hard drive.
That sounds messy.
Yes. And up popped something I hadn't looked at in many years. It's a one-pager that I developed years ago called Reliability Requirements Objectives.
Okay.
And essentially, it's the what I'll characterize as the quality attributes of reliability requirements. And I had 10 of them. And the reason why I had this one-pager is because there was a before and an after. The before is reliability was essentially a goal at GM. And we would issue a memo to the project team stating what the reliability goal is. And that memo would be part of the project team folder. And we'd talk about it at the various meetings. But it didn't influence the behavior because it wasn't a requirement. And it really was only a number.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I picked up the job I had for a number of years of manager of product reliability, I said, I know what reliability is. It's the probability that the item will perform its function over a certain amount of time under the environment and customer usage, et cetera. So you get a definition of reliability, but what if we broke that down into its component parts and we made sure that the reliability requirements were part of technical specifications and that each element of the reliability definition was in the specification?
Mm-hmm.
And then so I started to say, what makes for good requirements? And then I sent this took a couple of years, but I charged the functional reliability engineers with working with the functional areas to develop reliability requirements as part of the technical specifications for the doors and the suspension and the seats and the different subsystems of the vehicle.
But you're talking about something like a door. Part of its environment is, I mean, it has a latching force and alignment has to maintain, and it's got to be a certain weight. And so you can measure all of those things. So you're adding that engineering definition of reliability to that list. So it's got to be, you know, 80,000 cycles of opening and closing in North America environment, and it's got to do it with 99% reliability over 10 years or something like
yes.
that.
Yes. Yes. Okay? I'm saying complete the whole story. And so if the technical specification defines the functions very well,
mm-hmm.
then you could piggyback because the intended function is part of the definition of reliability. And so you could piggyback along with it. But if it didn't, then you had to work with the teams to say, look, what is this door supposed to do? So that it is defined well enough that because you don't just say it's 95% reliable, it's got to be, you got to understand what the intended function is.
Yeah, it's 95%. What are the 5% failures? What are you defining it? I've had that happen where a team will go, well, it is reliable. And he says, well, we had 15 failures. Well, those failures don't count. That was customer
yeah.
abuse. What?
Yeah.
What?
Exactly. I remember when I was, to take that example of the doors, when I was manager of the door testing. And we would test window systems, and we'd put them in the hot chamber and the cold chamber, and we'd run the windows up and down. And I said, okay, well, what's a failure? Well, if it doesn't go up or down. I said, well, wait a minute. What if it takes 30 seconds to go up or down?
Yeah, or 30 minutes.
Or 30 minutes. And well, then maybe that should be a failure. So we started looking inside the specifications, and we saw that, yaha, there are actual requirements. So we had to modify the testing accordingly. But to round off this story is I developed what I called the 10 quality objectives for reliability requirements that we measured how well the specifications were. After they actually worked on them for a while, we said, okay, let's have a review and we'll look at them. And so that's what I was cleaning out my archive. I had this old document. It had 10 objectives for reliability requirements. Anyway, that's the story of the topic.
Okay. Well, I'm struggling with what's 10. I'm thinking of like SMART goals is, you know, and I'm drawing a blank at what's the, all the letters stand for, but it was basically it's concise and measurable and things like that. And that's sure. only five. So I'm.
Yeah. Okay. So we know we have measurable, and that's important because the reliability metric that GM was using was defects per 1,000 vehicles. Mm-hmm. And when you're trying to develop a hinge system, defects per 1,000 vehicles is not really the right reliability requirement. No. So it's got to be more of a probability statement under certain circumstances. So measurable was important. But you told the story of the where you allocated 0.99% to five different components.
Right.
And my analogy to that is what I call benchmarking. So I want the reliability requirement for a particular part to be a challenge that if you meet it, you're going to be in the neighborhood of best in class.
Right.
Because what we found when we were allocating numbers is that oftentimes, the same story you told, oftentimes supplier A would, behind the scenes, they'd be going, wow, that was really easy.
Yeah.
I've been making 99% and they just gave me a 95% reliability target.
Yeah, cool. I'm not going to complain about that.
I'm not going to complain at all. And so one of the attributes is the reliability targets are benchmarked. In other words, they're a challenge to the supplier. A third one is very obvious. You have product requirements. That's the functional mm-hmm. statements. Mm-hmm. Time is the fourth one. Customer usage and operating environments, the fifth one.
Okay.
So now I'll just mention some of the ones that go beyond that. In certain cases, I wanted to consider degradation.
Yep.
So you might have a certain requirement at time zero, but over 10 years, you have some allowable degradation. And examples of that are closing efforts on the door.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it might not have to be as good after 10 years. Failure definition was another one. So I wanted to see that in the requirement specifications, it was clear what the definition of failure was.
Yeah, that one gets really spooky when it's a coating or a paint or, you know, or a labeling or stuff like that is, well, what if this blue turns into a really ugly green? And is that a failure or not? And, you know, it depends on who you ask, but sometimes the degradation will go into a beautiful soft blue instead of the dark. It's like, is that a failure? And it's, well, it's off brand. Of course it's a failure. And then that in and of itself is a rat hole that I've gotten into way too many times. And, yeah. But it created the discussion of, well, what is, if we're going to do a you know, we're going to look at this paint and if it blisters and peels and falls off, then that's bad. But what if it just changes color? And sometimes that matters. Sometimes it doesn't matter at all.
No, you're right. So you want to, as a reliability engineer, we need to ask the question, is it clear what the failure is?
Yep. Good point.
And another one, which is a little bit softer, but I had it in there because I wanted to be sure that my reliability engineers considered it, was a balance. The reliability requirements are balanced with the other vehicle and subsystem performance objectives. Mm-hmm. So we're not saying that reliability is a standalone. It's negotiated as part of the table.
Right.
So that was one. Another one that is close to our hearts, I called assumptions. Are the assumptions about test-to-field correlation or failure distributions valid?
Ooh, you called them out on that one.
And so that was, and so I always asked that question when I was reviewing reliability requirements. What's your underlying assumption? What failure distribution are you modeling, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I got I think it was in LinkedIn. No, it was direct email straight to me from a gentleman that said, I've been following your NoMTBF site for years, and I think I understand it, but this, what happened yesterday bothered me. It says they were buying parts from a supplier and they had a couple of failures. I think he said he had three failures, and that was too many and it didn't meet their MTBF guidelines or whatever. And because of how many units they had and how much time it had. So they came to a compromise that the supplier would supply 55 parts and they would run them for 2 months or something like that. And if they had three failures or more, then they would agree that they're not meeting the requirement. If they had two failures or less, they would say, hey, look, we're meeting the requirement. And they were doing very straight, assuming an exponential distribution. And they said, well, that's the same as 22 months or something like that. And so, you've had three failures. And so what this person was asking is it okay for me to ask what were those three failures and when did they occur? You know, how long into it? He says, because if they all failed at 10 years after initial use or something like that, but we only had three units, so we didn't meet our overall requirement, then testing them for 2 months, all brand new units, is going to be fruitless, because what we're really interested in is the wear out pattern that this thing's having. But and then he recognized that, you know, if they all failed in the first month, then the supplier's taking a great risk here, that they're not going to make it because they have infant mortality problems and wherever that source of that one is. So his basic question was, is the supplier taking advantage of us? He goes, yes, if they know it's a wear out mechanism that happens after 2 months, then they're good to go. If it's infant mortality, then they're going to lose. And so ignoring that in the design of this test is just folly. And so that it's exactly that point is, what's the assumption here? They were assuming that it's exponential, and I'm like, no, it's not. You don't know that.
it's incredible what the amount of errors that are made in the assumption category. And the last one is, are the reliability requirements incorporated into test technical specifications? And that's
really a check helpful step, I think.
That's a process step.
Yeah.
And so that was the checklist. I'm sure it could be updated and, you know.
Well, that sounds like an article we got to put out there. And, you know, because I'm sure you could, I mean, it sounds like you could write something about each one of those steps and how to implement it and so on. I think there, I just gave you a whole series to go after there, Gar.
Yes, that's right. But what's interesting is that in our previous podcast, we were talking about how a very simple task, but one that is meaningful, that is done over and over. Like you're talking about a weekly or a monthly, where the team goes off to find the biggest three problems or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you just keep at that, so what I did here, which worked really well, is I'd have this review and I'd just go through I think there were like 22 subsystems. And each week I'd go through a subsystem, look at the technical specifications, and then start all over. Mm-hmm. And do it again. And the next time, I sure hoped, and I kept records about each one of these as to how well it was in. And then in the next go around, we would hope that it was doing better. But you just keep going until it gets better and better.
Yeah.
And I like the concept of process improvement from a reliability standpoint.
Yeah. No, it's probably brilliant. You named it the quality aspects of reliability or something like that. Kind of leveraging Deming there, you know, his attributes and things like that. But one of my clients years ago really balked at the idea of attaching reliability requirements to the system or essential parts of it, elements of it. And I said, why is that? And he says, well, they're so hard to measure.
Yes.
So, and this was a group that was, you know, they brought me in because they were struggling and they knew they had to get reliability better. He says, well, if you choose to ignore reliability, then you end up with a situation where you get really good at doing things that don't matter related to reliability, you know. And they focused on yield, they focused on all these other things, but and those are all valuable things to do. But when it was ridiculous. It was to the point where they were, well, let's not do that test because it finds too many problems and it slows the process down and our yield numbers go too high. I mean, it was, you know, not as I could explain it to them when I saw this happening, but they had rationalized this to themselves that, well, that's not really an issue because it still works if it fails that test. But it was there because it was this latent defect that would show up 6 months later. And it says, well, it passes the requirements on day one, so it's we're shipping it. That's a yield consideration. And so they did. And then customers complained and, you know, stuff like that. And I'm like, think about it here, guys. You get, it's not just that measurement part. Is yes, it's difficult to measure. Get over that. You know?
Yes. There was a long-term battle at GM between the advocates of field-based reliability requirements and test-based. Mm-hmm. And the field-based people, and these are very smart people on both sides. And the field-based people said, well, what we really want to know is this part, is this system going to be reliable in the field?
Right.
And so we want to have a field reliability requirement, like 95% of the users in the field will not have a failure.
Right.
And the test-based people said, yeah, that's all fine, but the problem is the tests don't correlate to the field. And so we want to have work on test correlation and then and do the have a test-based requirement that we can measure during product development.
Well, did that discussion then bring in the quality guy saying, well, testing's too late. We need to get process stability in line so that you just don't have problems in test or the field. Did it go further upstream?
It did.
Okay.
That discussion went around what's called special characteristics. And so you identify which characteristics have to be controlled, like which dimensions, which material compositions, mm-hmm. so that you achieve reliability. In fact, one of my clients a few years back, we would, and I know this has been talked about in different podcasts, but we did this about 15 years ago, was in our reliability allocation, which is not my favorite topic in the world, but because of a lot of misuse, but in reliability allocation, we would go beyond the reliability numbers and allocate to the characteristics. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if we hold this dimension and hold this material composition or whatever the characters, this smoothness, we will achieve reliability. Yeah. And so we would allocate it all the way down to that.
Yeah. Now, I often leveraged, I had a number of clients that had a really strong critical to quality aspect or program.
Yeah.
And so I just, you know, co-opted that and called it, well, this is a critical to reliability characteristic. You know, and it's essentially the same. But it had the durability type characteristics to it. But it would go to material graininess or go to curing times. It would go to specific process steps that were deemed essential to get right and tight. And sometimes that was all it needed. And then we just didn't have problems.
I think that's the way you end up designing for reliability. That is not the only way, but that is a very important way. The short story and I probably shared this at one time or another, but we used to test when I was doing door testing. We used to test every time there was a new door impact beam. Mm-hmm. And inside the door between the outside and the inside sheet metal is the impact beam for side collisions.
Right.
And we put the two ends of the door impact beam on fixtures and we'd press down in the middle and do a force deflection curve and we'd be able to calculate whether or not it met requirements. And we test a certain number of samples and it was pretty expensive and time consuming. And then we got this idea that what if we held the cross section, geometric cross section, and held the material composition of the metal, if you held those things within tolerance, could you then calculate the forced flexion curve and avoid the test? And of course, the answer turned out, I say of course, it turned out
2 years later.
Yeah. And we did it for about a year of doing both.
Correlating it, yeah.
It correlated very well. And so we eliminated the need to do that testing. But that's one example.
Well, then you have that evidence of it's critical quality, but you also have that you could show that this material consistency aspect of it is the critical piece of it. Because if you get mm-hmm. a shoddy piece of metal, it doesn't matter how thick it is, it's going to just shatter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's you could look at both of them as CTQs, or you could say which one is more important.
Oh, but crashing into metal is just so much fun.
It's much more fun. It's very visual.
Yeah. It's, you know, but it's I mean, you had, it was about the time, if I remember this story, it was about the time you had these, the modeling tools became more prevalent and available. We had more finite element analysis yes. capability. And so it's a great opportunity to take advantage of it. And I see that more and more. It's whether it's thermal patterns or it's deflection patterns or vibration patterns, and even impact that can be simulated fairly well. Some old school mechanical engineer I worked with just didn't believe that we could model the impact piece of it. And we did. And then we used the high-speed camera to prove it to him. And then we, you know, it's going to fail right here. And it did. And it's like, whew, we were lucky there.
And then the challenge is correlating those models to the reliability outcome in some scientific way.
Yeah. For us, it was easy. If you dropped it and it was a handheld device. And if it hit that corner, and he was arguing that it will never hit that corner. And so I took it right in front of him and just dropped it. And of course it went straight to it. It was like peanut butter on the floor. It was just going to do that. And then it snapped and it would, you know, couldn't power it up. We took it apart and he says, I bet you it's this part, C28. And he goes, yep, C28's missing. It was like, okay. Yeah. You know, sometimes you get lucky.
It's the story of the quality attributes of reliability requirements that I exhumed from my archive. Yeah. And I think I'll update that. And that, like you say, that might be the subject of a good article or some refresh.
Yeah. Or at least, a note in the show notes to list them out. Because I know we went through them pretty quick and we certainly could spend way more time on each one of these aspects.
I'm just making an asterisk here to put those in the show notes.
There you go. Yeah, no, I'm sure there's other checklists and ideas and stuff like that out there. If you're listening to this going, oh, that sounds familiar, or we do it this way, because at HP, we had one that was called TQRDC, and then later they added E for environmental. And it was a supplier checklist, and it was a way to make sure you covered all the bases of it. The hard part was that reliability, much to my chagrin, or the R part of TQRDC, was not reliability, it was responsiveness. And how do you measure that? Do they answer the phone? Was the metric on it. You know, it was essentially that. And it is a little more complicated than that, but it was essentially, if we have a question, do they answer it? You know, kind of thing. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, where's the reliability part? And ties into your story of the recently about, you know, supplier quality and reliability aspect of it. But anyway, there are ways for us to create touchstones, and I'm sure there's other ones out there. We'd love to hear about them. So head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And that's a spot where you can get in touch with us directly, give us some ideas and join the conversation. You can find Carl and I and the other hosts on the show on LinkedIn or on our about pages at Ascendo. So, no, that's cool, Carl. You had 10 things. Were you trying to, you know, make your way to become a consultant?
10 is my favorite number, so
okay.
It falls into tens.
Yeah, see, I picked 42 as my favorite number.
Oh, gosh.
You know, so I never really got that list to work for me. It's never one pager.
Well, good conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. And I think we just listed 10 more topics for our podcast, too.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right. Cheers. We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.